Well, I think we have to recognise that there's actually been a number of tech shifts in the music industry over a very long period of time, and they all have a relationship with each other to some degree. So let's go all the way back. Let's go back to analog, when things were literally on magnetic tape and physical vinyl records, right? I am more than old enough to remember that. That's what music was when I grew up. And so when the first shift was when music went from being distributed in analog mediums to physical digital mediums, and basically from records and tapes to CDs, basically. And the CD as a product experience was vastly superior to what had gone on before it, because, you know, as a format, tapes, whether it be 8-track, which was very short-lived, regular tape and vinyl were very, very fragile formats. And they had endured for decades, literally since the 50s, I would say, 40, 50, since the 50s. And before that, it was cylinders and I don't know whatever else it was, you know. Not quite that old. Although some may disagree. So those formats had been around for decades and decades, and multiple generations had grown up with vinyl, especially, and then tapes, certainly in the 70s and 80s, as a recording format, whereas we didn't have a recording format before. So when the CD came out, I remember seeing the CD for the first time on television. There was a show in the UK called Tomorrow's World, and anybody who's over 45 years old in the UK, maybe 50 years old, we'll remember Tomorrow's World from the 70s and early 80s. And that was a technology show of its era. And they would have all new products on, and some were going to come to market and some never made it. And I remember very specifically how they introduced the CD to the UK public was it was about 1982, 83. They got Brian Dickinson, the lead singer from Iron Maiden, who were a hot new heavy metal band at the time, to come on the show and do a product demo. You know what the product demo of the CD was? It was positioned around not just its audio quality, but of course on TV you can't appreciate that. So they positioned it on TV around its durability.
Interesting.
Whereas a physical record can get scratched and it's finished, a tape can be left in the heat and can get mangled. It's just so easy to damage them, right? The CD, so they had, and you'll be able to find this on YouTube somewhere or video platform somewhere. Brian Dickinson, he had a kitchen bowl with washing up detergent in it. I don't know, we have Fairy Liquid, but I don't know what the equivalent in the US is, but Jif or Squeezy or I don't know. Whatever it is.
So
he's got the dish brush and he takes the CD, I can't remember, and he puts it in and he starts cleaning it with the dish brush. And he's scratching it and he's going, look how durable it is. And he takes it out and they dry it off and they put it in the player and it plays. And we all have this wow moment. It's like, oh my gosh, you could never do that with a cassette. It's like proof. So more than social proof in the product demo. But they got the hardest singer they could possibly find to run this thing through the product demo.
So my question on this one, because yeah, I feel like CDs didn't really gain traction until the early 90s. So why do you think why it didn't take off even despite being introduced in the early 80s?
Well, this is a recurring, it's a great question, by the way, and it's a recurring theme around all new formats, right? All new formats that require new technology for them to play take time for adoption, right? So, you know, we in the tech world, we just use the internet. And we take it for granted. It's like, oh, we've got some new technical shiny thing and we just pump it over the internet. And we've got some really clever people back in the office coding to make it work over whatever browser it is that you use. And we take that for granted. But in the physical formats world, it doesn't work like that, right? So you've gone from a social culture where every household had a color television and a record player, a radio or a wireless, and probably a tape cassette player as well, right? And they'd had them for decades. So the formats just kept feeding. They had every machine they could possibly imagine to play the formats. When CDs came along, no one had a CD player. And a CD player was incredibly expensive.
CDs
themselves, not so much, but the players were a big upfront investment. And that's the theme. You always have a big upfront investment. So when you think about TVs are a slight outlier, by the way, but when you think about a technology shift in formats, so we go to the CD player, and then the video games industry, which I know extremely well, goes through these cycles, you know, every 5 to 8 years. Every time there's a new PlayStation, every time there's a new Xbox, until the most recent generation where they changed it, you had to buy a new Xbox or a new PlayStation. So it wasn't, I was going to buy the new FIFA game or Madden game or whatever it was on the new PlayStation or new Xbox. I had to buy a new machine and new controllers. And it was a $1,000 investment, right? Mm-hmm. Every time you changed format. And CDs were no different. They were just one of the first. So it took, it did take time. Plus also the catalog wasn't available straight away.
That's right. So why invest in the CD player if not all of your favorite bands had
exactly.
CDs at the
time? Yeah. It's typical early adopter stuff. It's like, yeah, there's a few of my favorite records that are available, but not all. And it's $1,000 or pounds or whatever it is to buy. Why would I bother? I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait until 80% of my favorite records are available at a reasonable price. And the players come down to X, right? So that's how it goes. And that's how it still goes. So it did take, you're right, it did take a long time. I had a few CDs before I had a CD player, which was bizarre, and I wasn't the only one. You know,
just to like collect them, or just kind of like as a novelty.
I was just like, well, it's just like I'm buying it now for when I'm ready.
For when you have
when I can afford one, right? I still have my vinyl, because don't forget, it's an investment. Now here's the crux of the business part. So from the consumer's point of view, they've spent years or decades even investing in record collections. This is not something people do anymore, but we would invest in record and we'd have shelves of real estate full of records. You don't throw that kind of investment away overnight, especially when it can't be replaced straight away. So people waited, right? But it did happen, and it happened over time. And the business outcome for the record labels was like the gold rush for them. Why? Because they were able to resell their entire catalogs multiple times over without having to develop any new music.
Mm-hmm.
Because people were just going to replace what they already had. Yeah, sure, they might buy the odd new CD from a new band, but by and large, it was a catalog business. And it was the gold rush for record companies, because they were like, this is free money.
Totally is.
People are, one for one record collections were getting replaced over a period of 10 years. And it was cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching every single year. The record execs were just like, I get my bonus and I don't even have to show up.
Listen, that we could add this or file it back under the why do legacy bands endure? Like, just because very similarly, a lot of them, you know, will do a 15, 20 year remaster, remixing.
Yeah.
Something or extended edition. I mean, we keep on talking about Metallica. They do it. They're at that point though, where like, yeah. You know, because they had such a massive run in the 80s yeah. and 90s. Now yeah. they're able to do 20 year like remaster, and they yeah. can do the same run like on the 20 yeah. year anniversary of Kill 'Em All or Ride the yeah. Lightning, it's Master of Puppets. They can just do another remaster, and it's free money.
Yeah, they all do it, and actually, funnily enough, there's a story, sorry to harp on about my book. There's a story about the Bonfire box set that AC/DC did, which I helped them with. And the story of that is in the book. And the interesting thing about them is that they refuse to rehash old stuff that hasn't been out before. So that's why AC/DC don't have a greatest hits album.
Because they
refuse to sell things to their fans that they've had already. So they will do boxes.
Very ethical of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure how green they are, but but it's like, if we're going to give the band something, fans something new, just give them something they've not heard before.
Right.
Or they've not had access to. And I've been to their record company office in Australia, and I've been to the studio, and I've been to the vault. Right. And I wasn't allowed to take pictures. Right. So I walked into the air conditioned vault at Albert Studio in Sydney. And in there is a it is the AC/DC treasure trove of all the original from the 1970s, mostly original Ampex 458 2-inch master tapes on shelves like this. And there's a gap about this big that you walk it down, and it's temperature controlled and locked.
Of course, yeah.
So the engineer, who I won't name, let me in. And I'm looking, I'm looking at the spine going, Highway to Hell, Back in Black. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Are you, is, would you say AC/DC is your favorite band?
Oh, it was without a doubt.
I was about to say, so it must have been just been, yeah, it must have been just like heaven for you then. Wow, that's incredible.
And then to do some work with them and to help them out, it was just phenomenal. And then I saw these tapes, these cats, back to the topic about catalog, of like, I've never heard of that before. And there's stuff in there.
Tempting is that when you see unreleased material from a band from like their heyday, right in front of you, but you can't listen to it.
It'll happen. It'll happen eventually. I mean, look, there was a rumor there was a new Beatles song going to come out recently, and Hendrix. There's new undiscovered Hendrix stuff coming out all the time. I'm sure it's not undiscovered. It's just not been released. But anyhow, we'll get into the ethics another time. So the outcome of the technology shift from analog to digital was that everybody was happy to rebuy their record collections because they were getting a durable format and they were getting crystal clear quality. The other thing was it was portable. So the only portable format that we had in the analog era was the Walkman, the tape cassette, which wasn't a phenomenally great experience, but it was an experience. And CDs now meant that you could have crystal clear quality, you know, almost in your back pocket. So that was the number one. So the shift from analog to digital, and it was happy days for the record labels because it was just catalog, right? It was just happy days. And that was a real golden era. The next one was not so happy for the record labels. And it was to your point about the change in distribution. So this was from physical digital, so from CDs to downloads. Right. So this is when the internet became a thing, because in the early CD era, there was no internet. It happened in the early 80s all the way through to the early 90s. To be honest, the internet as we use it now didn't really happen until after 95. Windows 95 is really what got it started. And then from there, from 95 onwards, you know, Napster and MP3s and file sharing became a thing. And all of a sudden, what happened was consumers had this ability to share. Whereas music before was a solitary experience. You could listen with people, but you couldn't share the actual property, the intellectual property, unless you just made a tape copy, which people did all the time, but it wasn't really a threat to the business. The internet was, and this has been very widely documented about the effects of the internet on the music industry, which still, you know, they're living with today, but they found a way to live with it. But there was many, many years, I don't know if it's 5 years or 10 years, there's many years where the record industry couldn't live with the internet.
That's that piece too. I mean,
Metallica were a big part of
you
it.
You talk about AC/DC. That's your band. Metallica's my band, and Metallica in the very early days of this, you know, very much fought against Napster and tried to take it all down. It was a wild ride in the early 2000s.
And what happened there was that was music sharing without paying, you know, basically. And the outcome was piracy, right? And a challenge to the conventional business model. So, you know, the record industry had endured and enjoyed a conventional business model for decades. And then they just had the gold rush, you know, in the CD era. But this business model put the industry to the sword. And the reason for that is that the record companies were no longer the distributor. In fact, no one was the distributor. The consumers could share it amongst themselves. It was the Wild West as far as, you know, record labels were concerned. But the worst part about it was they had no control of distribution, which means they had no control of how they got paid. And the short story was they didn't get paid. And that was a threat. So the music industry had a very, very widely documented era of really suffering. I lived through a bit of that, actually. And I talk about it a bit in the book. When we went from analog to digital and when downloads came in, It really did kill the industry. Jobs started drying up, scaling back, you know, lots of uncertainty, fear and uncertainty. you know, so it's not a new concept in the tech industry. This has been going on since the dark ages. So they weren't getting paid. They weren't in control of distribution, and there was no regulation. There was Napster. There was a bunch of others as well. And I remember as an early adopter using Winamp and, you know, burning my own CDs onto MP3s so I could put it onto a hard disk MP3 player in the late 90s, early 2000s. So it was not that long ago, actually. So that was the sort of the darker days for the industry. But it was the prequel, if you will, to the third technology shift, which was the real shift from, well, we'll see it as the shift from downloads to streaming, but what it actually is the shift from ownership or to access,
mm-hmm.
right? So we went from owning music, this is the business model, to accessing music without owning it. So it's the difference between buying a car and leasing a car, right?
Or even just like buying the software versus software as a service. Yeah.
You either own it or you don't, but you still get the benefit of using it under certain conditions, right? So the industry it was probably about 20 years ago now. Spotify's been around that long. A lot of people don't realize it.
20 years?
Yeah, they were the trailblazers.
Wow.
It was, or nearly, 50, certainly 15. I remember somebody, a music producer, phoning me up one day, Steve Bush, lovely fellow. And we used to be flatmates, and he's done some brilliant things in his life. He phoned me up and he goes, Harv, what are you doing? Why are you bothering with those MP3s? He says, just get Spotify. And he was the first person to tell me about Spotify, and it blew my mind.
I had a similar story too. I was using Pirate Bay to download all my music for free. That was pretty much my source for maybe like 5-6 years in like the early 2000s. And then same thing. I remember I was with one of my bandmates, and they were like, dude, like I hear you. I know that that's like the way that people download music. Like I was doing too, but like, just try Spotify. It's actually incredible. Like you can just listen to any type of music you want. And I was like, huh? Okay. So I did. And it was incredible.
It just blew my mind. And I just thought at this point, all those records sitting on my shelves, all that CD collection was obsolete.
Right.
And within a year, I had all my shelves back, right? which wasn't intentional, but that was the consequence of it, right? It's like, right. There's no value in having all this stuff now. I've got 30 million songs in my pocket, literally. So the outcome of this really was, because it was a format change, it took a long time for the industry and the artists to get on board with it, because what it did is, excuse me, it challenged the business model and the income streams for everyone, especially the artists. So the artists resisted. So there were like the Beatles, AC/DC, the Legacy, they were just like, no. It's like, you're not giving our songs away for 0.00000 of a cent.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just no way, right? But eventually push came to shove where, you know, they got past the tipping point and it was like,
you have to embrace some of these new channels. Like if you can learn from Metallica's misstep they sued Napster and I'm pretty sure they won and Napster ended up becoming obsolete, but they ended up, their reputation was damaged pretty severely for a number of years after that.
Yeah. But you know, the irony of that, Andy, is that Napster is now a streaming service.
Oh, it is?
It's bona fide. Even BMW have it installed in their cars. I mean, it's just like another one. It's like
Diesel. Oh, that's hilarious. Others, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. I mean, it's become an aggregator business now. So whatever brand you want to put on it, whoever owns the Napster brand is just an aggregator on the back end for an internet service provider. That's all it is. That's why there's so many of these companies now. But the outcome was that the record labels lost control of distribution to some degree. They lost control of the revenues, but from sales, because no one was buying anymore, because we went from purchasing to access, ownership to access. But what they gained was licensing. So the business model changed dramatically for the first time in decades. So what happened was eventually when everyone came on board, you know, Universal and some of these big record labels now, they have shares in some of these streaming companies because they realized it's like they missed the boat on building it themselves. They missed the internet. if there's one thing you could say about the music industry as a lost opportunity, after the gold rush, they failed to see the internet as an opportunity. They saw it as a threat.
That was a big mistake.
And they spent 10 years, 15 years in the wilderness as a result, and then they lost control. Right. And it's just a fact. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So now they have some ownership. They have some more control over licensing, because the way that the streaming platforms access music and have it propped on their systems is that they pay a license. Right. So, and the record companies now are doing pretty well out of it, because it got well past the tipping point a long time ago, and it's a volume play now. The real challenge, and I have to admit, I like streaming services as much as anyone. I was always an early adopter. You know, I was burning CDs as MP3s and putting them on Winamp long before I had ADSL in my apartment, long before anybody, while everyone was still on 56K dial-up. I mean, that's just me, right? And I used it for music predominantly, and the internet, and a bit of video gaming. And so I embraced it, but it was very difficult for the artists. And what happened for the artist was that the record companies found a way to make it pay through licensing, in a pretty positive way. But because of the low artist royalty share, the artists get very little from streaming, very little compared to what they would have got if they sold a record in the old days. So what they've had to do, and there's lots of conversations and lots of discussion, data around what they've lost versus the old days, but the old days are gone. It's just history. You can't go back. It literally is just written in stone. So I can't remember. There's a great conversation on LinkedIn going on about, basically don't compare, right?
Mm-hmm.
To compare is like dancing with the devil. And this is one of those, whether you compare yourself to a peer at work, or you compare your company to another company, or you compare your product to another company, we all do it. But there comes a point where it becomes a sort of negative spiral, and especially if you need to be differentiated. So if you compare the old business model to the new business model, it's completely pointless, because there's nothing of consequence that can come out of it. So the artists get paid very little. So they've had to reinvent because of this technology shift, they've had to reinvent their business models as well. So they don't make that much money now off recorded music. They make it off licensing. So they'll license it, TV, film, advertising.
Well, that's why they're selling. So there's a couple of different paths that I'm seeing, like from these legacy artists, it's selling their back catalog. Like, who is it? Bruce Springsteen, I feel like, sold his for like $500 million, like that. But, you know, for some of these non-massive artists, I feel like what I've seen more lately, it's really just having to tour, because then when you sell merch directly to the consumer, when they're seeing, you know, people are seeing you at a show or whatever, then you can keep 100% of, well, not 100%, but you know what I mean? You can keep a larger percentage And that's one piece. The other piece is that I've seen that I do like is almost like exclusive drops. So, hey, we only have like 200 shirts made. There's a limited run, or like 200, whatever, CDs, and it's a little bit more expensive than usual, but they're finding their hardcore fans that they know are going to show up and buy just about anything. And then they're offering more goods to them.
And the change in the model is direct to fan. So, you know, it's D2C. So they have a relationship with their fans that the internet allows and powers, if they can do it right. And they can monetize it in any which way they want. And there's a number of different ways in which that has done, and they can be very, very successful about it. So the artists have just had to become, and the managers of those artists have had to become more self-empowered.
More entrepreneurial.
More entrepreneurial, more creative. But it can absolutely be done. It takes longer. You don't have the investment up front in the old model where the record company would throw money at you. But at the same time, you don't have to pay them back either, right? Out of royalty checks that you might not see for 10 years. So there's a number of artists who ironically struggle. I feel fail to bring their names to mind at the moment, but there's a number of artists that have started that way. I mean, Ed Sheeran was a great case. You know, he ended up signing with Rocket Management, which is Elton John's management company, and Atlantic Records. But he started selling tape cassettes out of a backpack. You know, he would do three shows a day around London, and he would literally, what he would do is that every show he'd sell cassettes, he would take email addresses, he'd build his list. I mean, and that's just how it's done. You have to do the hard yards, right? But that email list was the thing that, you know, eventually ended up with thousands or tens of thousands of names on it after he'd done all the hard work, got him his first single in the charts by himself. And then all of a sudden, following like sheep, like they do, they're just right. Like, ooh, what's this shiny thing that I know nothing about? All of a sudden came out of nowhere. Well, these things don't come out of nowhere. Somebody did a lot of work. They just flew under the radar. But D2C is absolutely what's come out of it. And there's challenges in that because there's a lot of noise, because there's a lot of people doing it, because it's very empowering. But those who know who can do it, who can do it well, do really well out of it. And there's no reason why you know, an artist can't have a career now if they can build and keep their own fan base, like you say, with these exclusive drops.
Yeah, and just creating a more one-to-one relationship with fans. I feel like you know, we referencing back to Kiss, where they had the mystique of nobody being able to see them. Now it's almost like you can talk to any of your favorite bands. You know, especially like, you know, if they're non mega stars at this point, but I mean, everyone has a Twitter account at this point, that you can message them, or is on Instagram, TikTok, whatever, and you can see like day in their life, even Twitch. I mean, a lot of people are like on Twitch and they're playing video games and they're just talking directly with their fans. And so that's another piece that's really empowered individual artists as well.
Yeah. And even some of the more switched on bigger artists do it as well. So, you know, back to your favorites, Metallica, they have on their YouTube channel, they've got some great stuff, and you see the behind behind the scenes stuff. I mean, I know it's done on a phone or whatever, but it's good enough quality. And you see Lars or whoever it is going into a fan meet before a show, or there's a little video of him just before the show starts. He's under the drum riser, and you see from his perspective.
Oh right? My God, like, I love
it. And it's super interesting, right? Yeah. It's like, well, this is how it really is. I remember being under and besides the stage. I know what it's like, but for most people, they have no clue, right? They're just, a lot of them are just normal people. You don't realize, you know, I was on a flight. Well, I was at the PMA summit last year in San Francisco, and Lars Ulrich was on the flight, funnily enough.
Are you serious? He was on a commercial flight?
Yeah. He was in business class. Right?
Oh my God. I don't know what happened. How incredible. Do you say hi?
I didn't know, because I thought he was going to punch me in the face. It's just like, hey, can I have a selfie? You know, it's just, it's not cool.
Oh, I would have flipped out. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I'm looking at we land at SFO, and his hair's all over the place, his baseball cap's off, and it basically literally looked like he'd been dragged through a hedge backwards. I looked at him and thought, God, you're really small, aren't you?
Small guy.
Really,
yeah.
He's really short.
Yeah, I think he's like 5'5", 5'6", maybe. Yeah,
he's really short. He's dressed, you know, a bit like a very scrawny. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's very scrawny and rough looking. And I'm looking at him going, that's Lars Ulrich. There's not many people who would
like the most important drummer, you know, potentially.
Probably
the
you and
years.
Me, and that's about it, right? And I did have that thought. I was like, should I go and talk to him? Should I not? And I chose not to. It's like, I love Metallica, but you know, he looked like he just wanted to be left alone after the
he's chilling.
Yeah. But he was flying home back from the Wembley concert, from the Foo Fighters tribute concert.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He'd been playing with Brian Johnson at AC/DC and Foo Fighters as a guest. So I knew exactly where he'd been, and he'd flown in and flown back. So he looked like a bag of washing, but he was he was wonderfully polite with all the staff. And it was just nice to see, you know, just being a regular guy, you know. Anyway, getting a bit off topic here.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
So that's it. So we're at streaming now, and we're at licensing and direct to fan, and the business model has settled down. I mean, we could be here all day going, well, what's next? And you know, there are research companies. There's one in the UK called Media Research, who are really good, actually. And you know, they speculate, you know, what's next? And fandom empowerment, D2C, and niching down. It's all part of the mix, right? Because there's only so much you can do with it. The technology is not going to change anymore in the foreseeable future to change the experience. So this creativity and the entrepreneurial part of it is interesting. The other thing that's interesting, especially for legacy artists, is ownership, right? Intellectual property. So if you look at the Taylor Swift case, and on a much lower level, I've been involved in similar things, where she actually fell out with the record label. You know, it was, well, you know, Prince did it, he fell out, George Michael did it, and they all went to court, and all well documented, so we don't need to go into it. But what she did is she re-recorded her biggest albums. And the reason that she did that is that she owned the intellectual property. She owned all the revenue from it. But do you know what actually happened over time? Because she wanted to go direct to fan, right? She's got this huge fan base. So she was a little bit like giving her old record label the birdie, because she's like, you sold my catalog without my permission. I'm just going to go re-record it and you can't stop me and I'm going to own it. You know what happened? Her old catalog got bigger. Right, because everybody wanted the originals.
Right,
she slightly shot herself in the foot, but I'm sure she doesn't care.
I'm sure she's doing fine. coming off of the most successful tour of all time. Yeah.
We'll dry our tears.
Yeah. Right.
So that's it. So technology shifts do play a huge part in our lives, whether we recognize it or not. For observers like us, then you know it's a point of interest to observe, discuss, document. And for those of the people listening in and watching, if you're watching, if you're wondering what a CD is or a tape cassette or a vinyl record, please go onto the internet and search for it. This is how people over 40 years old used to consume their music. So if Spotify is the only thing that you know, or Apple Music or whatever it is, there's a whole world that came before it that we've just been talking about for 20 minutes.
Well, let's talk through, because now, right, we talked through this rise of the artists and the ones that do really well. What about the ones that don't do so well? Or maybe they rose to fame, rose to prominence, and then couldn't handle it. Let's talk through the artists that don't make it and why.
Well, should we put a number on it? The bizarre thing is, the ironic thing is, everything that we've been talking about so far, we've only been talking about 5% of the market.
Right.
Because only 5% really make a living out of music, right?
I'm surprised it's even 5. I think it'd be even smaller than that.
I think you've got to define what does making a living
right.
look like. The ones who hit it big, you know, the Beyoncés of this world and whatever. Yeah,
0.001%.
Yeah, we're into micro decibels, you know.
Right.
So you're absolutely right from that point. I'm just talking about people who just sort of get by.
Mm-hmm.
Jobbing musicians and so on and so forth. So what about to your point, what about the 95%? What happens to them? Well, you know, I've managed a band who got a major record label contract and failed. The story's in the book. And that was a 10-year journey. There is no such thing as an overnight success. Similarly, there's no such thing as an overnight failure either. But you never hear about it. And so why do good bands fail? Well, it's quite obvious why the bad bands fell, because they weren't very good, right? But generally speaking, they're not the ones that get signed or get a shot, right? Generally speaking. So why do they fail? Well, at the core essence of it is that the product's not good enough, right? Even if you have got a good product, and this applies in business everywhere, having a good product isn't good enough. Unfortunately, there are so many other factors and so many other conditions of your potential success, whether you've got a great band, a great artist, a great album, even a potential hit record, right? And all the conditions are right, it can still fail, right? Because there's so much that's out of your control. So one of the things that is out of your control potentially, and it can work for you and it can work against you, and this happens very cyclically in music, is to be part of a movement. So music on its own, if we think about category, right? Music on its own doesn't exist in a vacuum. And there are categories of music, and you know, most of us are familiar with the big ones like country music, R&B, hip-hop, rock, metal, so on and so forth. But within those categories, there are cultural movements that sometimes can define whether you're successful or not. I'll give you, let's look at some examples that people may recognize. So in the UK, where I am, in the 90s, there was a huge cultural movement around music and culture called Britpop, which was music that was celebrated for the sound of its Britishness. Now, most people will think, well, what the hell is that, right? And the Beatles is probably about as British as I could connect the two. And because they're very British sounding. However, this 90s movement was more independent sounding, more alternative. It was more of an alternative movement, but it was huge. And you'll know one of the bands, which was one of the most successful bands, that was Oasis. So Oasis was probably the biggest and most enduring legacy band to come out of the Britpop movement. Mm. Blur were another, and there were a number of others, Pulp and so on and so forth. Funnily enough, they're all enjoying a revival at the moment.
Right. Yeah, that's the, that. Yeah, it comes and goes. Right.
Yeah, so these things happen in cycles, right? Every 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, for as long as people are still alive to remember it, people will reminisce. So there is a bit of a Britpop revival going on at the moment, although it be moderately low level. But they're all legacy bands. But in the US or internationally, people will remember the grunge movement, right? In the 90s. And the predominant artist was Nirvana. But you also had Soundgarden, Mudhoney. I don't know. Can you think of any?
Alice in Chains. Yeah.
Alice in Chains. Absolutely. And they're all still enduring artists today. But what people certainly these days don't recognize is that they came out of a movement, a cultural movement, which is called grunge. And it originated in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And whereas Britpop originated by and large in Manchester and London in the UK and some other places too, but the big cities in the UK. And if you're in this movement and you're pretty good, the conditions are already made for you to be successful, right? Because you're part of the movement. The media want you. The media, you know, all of the channels and distribution, all the lights are green, right? If you're an artist in that time that goes against the grain, but you're brilliant, all the lights are red. Right.
Well, that's like all the hair metal bands before the grunge movement, right? Like what happened exactly to Motley Crue going into the 90s, you know?
Yeah. All the lights turn red. Right. And in my book, I talk about the band that I manage. All of our lights were kind of orangey red and ended up turning red. But there was a flicker of green for a while. But we recognized the challenge at the time because we were living through the Britpop era and we couldn't get arrested. Because we weren't Britpop, right? If you weren't Britpop, you didn't exist,
right?
It was all TV and radio would play, and there was no internet in those days, so that was the challenge. You couldn't make your own path. You couldn't forge your own way. So being in a category that's not easy to define, or not being part of a movement like those kind of things, and you've got, I don't know, the British Invasion in the 1960s, where the Beatles and the Herman's Hermits and you had the psychedelic movement in the late 60s coming out of San Francisco. You had the Birds and Janis Joplin, Flower Power.
Pink Floyd.
They're all movements. The psychedelic movement in the early mid-70s, the record company I worked for, was a huge part of that. They had King Crimson and Roger Waters and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And, you know, all of those artists we had through the psychedelic and the prog rock era. So they're all evocative of their time. And the bands that endure are the ones that can survive the movement being over, right? So if Nirvana was still around, they would survive. If Oasis were still together, but their music still endures, right? Which is the evidence that they would still be huge if they were still together. So music is cyclical because it's a fashion. The business is a fashion, and therefore fashion is cyclical. And these movements are the tidal wave in which the bands can do well or have all the lights turn red, right? So we've been through Britpop, grunge. There was the movement that I grew up in was called the new wave of British heavy metal. And I guarantee you that almost zero people listening to this podcast have heard of it. But you've heard of the bands that came out of it, because Iron Maiden are one of the most famous bands to come out of what we used to call New Wobbenham, which is the abbreviation of New Wave of British Heavy Metal.
Right.
So there's Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, and Def Leppard, right? Now, Def Leppard were the outlier because they weren't heavy enough to be considered true British metal, and they were too transatlantic to be considered British. So the British shunned them. And here's a very interesting story. I meant to tell it earlier, but it's actually probably a good time to tell it. In 1983, Def Leppard had their third album, which was called Pyromania. And that they'd already started to gain traction in the United States with the previous album, which was produced by Mutt Lange as well, which was High and Dry. It's a great record, actually. Some great songs on that album.
Yeah, I love High and Dry. Yeah,
High and Dry. I love High and Dry. Let it. It's just, oh, it's a great record. And then Pyromania came out, which was the album that Mutt wanted to make with AC/DC, but AC/DC went new way. That's way too commercial for us. So he made it with Def Leppard, and it was huge in the States. It blew, you know, Photograph, the video for Photograph blew the doors off MTV. It blew the radio, FM radio apart. And it was like the second British invasion of America. Wore the Union Jack t-shirt in the video and all of that. And it was all good. But what happened in the UK is that all the lights turned to red for them, because they were considered too American to be British and not British enough to be British. So that they missed out on the movements and the categories in which they should have been a part of, right? Because they were of that era. And I remember very, very clearly being at the Apollo Theatre in Manchester, England, in 1983, on the Pyromania tour. Pyromania had just gone platinum in the United States, right? That's a million albums. And they played to 400 people. Oh, in their near hometown, the month after, right? The theater holds nearly 3,000, and it only had 400 people in it. I could walk around it and hear myself think while they were on stage.
Wow.
All those songs. So here's the difference between being part of a movement where all the lights are green and not fitting into a category. And it's the same product in different contexts, right?
Right. And just knowing your target audience too. I mean, there's like a marketing lesson in there too. Like, hey, like probably should be more milking the American audience versus trying to make that hometown work despite,
that's what happened eventually.
Despite it seeming like it would make sense to tour around where you're from to have some of that hometown love. It didn't fit at the time.
That's what happened. And it actually very sadly took a tragedy for them to break their home market. They didn't come back, from what I can remember anyway, they didn't come back to the UK until 1987, right? On the Hysteria album, which was also huge. And it was probably the most glossy, schmaltzy rock album ever made. It was,
I love Hysteria, like,
It's just this gloss. All you can hear is gloss and treble, you know, and tunes. And and it took Rick Allen, the drummer, unfortunately, to have a tragedy losing his arm. And for that to be well documented in the press, and for his personal tragic story to be reported and recorded through Kerrang and all the music press, and people, I think, started to realize that we had a band here, a homegrown band here, who had gone to America and been massively successful, and we'd not given them any credit.
Mm.
And so their story was very well documented in the press, because they couldn't tour, they couldn't play, they couldn't record anything while things with Rick were very uncertain for a good year or two. And the band nearly imploded multiple times.
Right.
And that story took people along with them on the journey. And I was at the Monsters of Rock show in 87 at Castle Donington when they did their first comeback gig with Rick Allen. And he'd learned to play again with his feet.
Yeah.
And his electric. I was there. And what was really interesting was that their record label was there as well to see if they could actually still do it, because they were like millions in the hole. They'd recorded this album and they didn't know if they were going to continue. They didn't know if they could do it anymore. with Rick Owens, but the band stood by Rick. And at that show, they were supposed to have two drummers, right?
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was the drummer from who was playing with Status Quo at the time, had a full proper drum kit, and Rick had his electronic drum kit. And Rick was just going to play along with the other drummer. The other drummer didn't turn up.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was a no-show. It was a complete no-show. And Rick did the whole show by himself, first time, in front of 80,000 people in the UK. And from then on inwards, they were considered homegrown, right?
Well, there you go.
But that's what it took for Def Leppard to break big in the UK, in their own home market. And it wasn't because of their product, unfortunately. Anyhow, it's a tragic story, but it had a, I don't say happy.
Happy ending. Happy-ish.
It had a more positive ending than it could have. Let's put it that way. And they're still going. Right?
Yeah, they are. They're still, touring with Motley Crue. So
they're still going. So there you go. So there's lots of reasons why bands fail. And then the other reasons are that bands and artists are fallible to a couple of things, right? First of all, they are their own worst enemy, right? Like any artist, a painter, a creator, you know, they are fallible to themselves, right? Not realizing, you know, what needs to be done. They're not business people. And they sometimes do have a tendency to self-destruct. Maybe not physically, but making poor decisions.
A great example of this, and again, you know, because I'm obviously a Metallica fanboy, but back in 2003, they released a document. I don't know if it was in 2003, but the documentary is around 2003 when they're recording an album called Saint Anger, and it is kind of it's in between. It's them. Being recorded over like a 3-year period where they are pretty much trying to figure out like what they're going to do to move forward, right? Because they had this massive decade of success in the 90s, and they're realizing that things are changing. This is like in the middle of the Napster era where they're trying to figure out, are we still relevant? James Hetfield is still struggling with alcoholism, and they don't know if they can make good songs anymore. And so it's an incredible like glimpse into almost self-destruction as a band. But you know, they ended up being fine, but it's still an incredible documentary. Definitely recommend it to anyone.
I've seen it. It was filmed in their studio in San Francisco, right? And they've got all the flags and stuff up on the wall. They're still in that facility, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know, what's really interesting, I think, as you were talking, I was thinking about Metallica and that situation, is that I think it was Rick Rubin who said it. I can't remember. It was somebody really big producer or someone. And they basically said, oh, no, it was the guys at Aerosmith. They said, you know, the bigger the band, people think that when you sign a record deal, you've made it. And that's not true. It's like being in a tech company and being a founder and you're getting your first customer and you think you've made it, right? It's like, we're on our way. It's like, no, you're not, right? It's sorry to be a bummer.
But the very beginning,
you're barely scratched the surface. So signing a record deal is just meeting one of the conditions. It's not actual success. And he basically, I think it was Steven Tyler from Aerosmith. He says, you know what? And I saw this documentary about them, and they were having an argument with their A&R guy, their artist and repertoire guy, which for people listening, that's the creative person inside the record label. That's the artist liaison, helps them make the right creative decisions, selects the songs, producers, and so on and so forth. And their A&R was a very well-known, successful A&R, right? And basically, Aerosmith's management having this discussion with Steven Tyler, the lead singer, and the conclusion was, you know what? You'd think after selling tens of millions of records that you wouldn't have any problems, would you? You wouldn't think you would have. But the key takeaway, and actually the Aerosmith manager at the time, I don't remember his name, said it explicitly, like Harry says, you know what? The bigger a band gets, the bigger the problem. The problems don't go away, they just get bigger. And I think that's true in business, right? I mean, look at what happened with, you know, Virgin Atlantic and the British Airways scandal. many, many years ago. Virgin,
it's because more people are relying on you. More people, you touch so many more people, and influence then you become so many more people.
And you become a threat in certain areas for other people. You become a competitive threat, whereas before people were just like, "Hey, whatever, go and form an airline, see if it bothers us." You know, it's like 5 years later, it's like, "Oh, he's eating our lunch. We better do something about this." You know, and so it's just life, and it does happen. So, and it happens in music too. So the bigger you are, the bigger the band gets, the bigger the artists get, the bigger the problems get. It's just that simple, right? Wealth management, creative decisions, fans, management, corruption, you know, management not being all that, you know. And there's no school to go to for these. A lot of people that work in the music industry, most music companies are three or four employees or less, right? So it's a very, very small industry. It's not like you can walk into like the sales force of the music industry and just buy a service off the shelf. It just doesn't work that way. It's a very individual business. It's a very creative, person-led business. So you've got the artists themselves being their own worst enemy. Got some great stories in the book about that, my experiences with some of those artists. Poor management or record label choices, sometimes avoidable, sometimes maybe not, right? Sometimes it's just luck of the draw. Sometimes it was just a bad decision. And then the third, and this is also prevalent to all businesses, you just need to have a great team of people around you. You know, you just have to have great people. I mean, never mind the records and the music and the fans and this, that. It all starts with a great team. If you don't have a great team, a great A&R, a great label, the right level of investment, the right manager, the right lawyer, a good accountant, you know, a good road crew, who you can depend on week in, week out on the road, you don't really have anything, no matter how good your record is. So I've worked with great teams. I've worked with average teams. I've worked with some pretty poor ones as well. And I know what it feels like. And it is the difference, right? No matter what the record's like. So of course, the more money you've got, the more you can buy into it. But in the early days of an artist's career, people are doing it for love, not money. Because there isn't any money,
right? So I mean, if you're getting into
choose,
that's the thing too. I mean, I even today, right, after being in bands for well over a decade, it's just I don't even really think about money at all. Yeah. Like you play it to, you know, as a creative outlet, and I think if you are trying to make a go of it, then it is something that you have to really try to figure out, like the right ways of monetizing. But it's not as simple as just releasing an album or even just playing a couple of shows.
Yeah, I think the creator industry in general is like that. I mean, I've been through this experience in the past, I don't know how long it's been with this book that I've done, but being a publisher and learning the publishing category. So I've got an article coming out in a couple of weeks on LinkedIn about learning a new category and orientating yourself to it. So if there's anyone out there who's needs to onboard in a new category and doesn't have enough time, or they don't think they have enough money, there's some great advice in there how to get it done. So I had to learn a new category pretty quickly to understand how am I going to launch this book, right? I know nothing about the book publishing world, nothing, literally less than nothing. So I had to go learn it and spend some money and invest time and effort more than anything. To learn it, and what I learned was there's no money in it. it didn't take me to become Einstein to realize that after about 3 seconds. But the question was, where do you make the right investments? Where can you potentially make money? Where should you invest? Where should you not invest? Your approach to category management, which category should you be in? Where should I spend money? What's not worth spending money on? Because as with any new endeavor in any business, tech included, you can spend as much money as you can get. It doesn't make it right, right? So if you want to spend 10 million against this tech stack and this marketing and this, it doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. So you can throw money at anything, but usually what I find is the less money you've got, the more creative you have to be. Funnily enough, by a twist of irony, you can learn more and be leaner and be more effective if you've got less money.
Working with constraints, that's a very real thing.
It is. It is. And sometimes I actually find it better to work that way.
Absolutely.
Throw money at something. And that's why I still do a lot of my own research at the PMA and organizations I work for, because I'm closer to the data. I'm closer to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though sometimes I don't have to, sometimes I choose to.
Let's wrap up the list and let's chat about the very last piece that you wrote down here. And that's really kind of bringing it back home, talking about the companies that we're working for and spotting the quote unquote rock stars. And so why don't you share kind of what you wrote down here?
Yeah, no, funnily enough, I wrote this down a couple of days ago after I did a post on LinkedIn about it, which just took off beyond all expectation. I didn't realize it hit such a nerve. It had like, I don't know, nearly 30,000 views in 36 hours.
Wow.
And I think it was one of the biggest posts I've had this year. And it really resonated with people. So I thought, I'll bring it to the discussion today. So basically, I came up with six things of how you as an individual in a company could spot someone who's a rock star in your company. Well, I don't mean Elton John or someone in stack heels and star-fangled glasses and a guitar. I mean somebody who really shines that we can celebrate, somebody who really delivers and that should be celebrated in your company. But in order to do that, they need to be acknowledged. But there's some common traits that, you know, you don't need to have all of them, but, you know, more than one would be good that we can identify. So let's go through this. The first thing is they get, am I allowed to swear?
You're allowed to swear. Yeah.
All right. They get shit done, right? They just get the job done. It's like they take care of everything without the minimum of fuss. I was hoping you're going to bleep me out because I've always wanted to be bleeped out.
I can bleep you out. Here, I'll go back and I'll bleep it out. Don't worry about it.
Bleep it out in the trailer.
Okay.
They get shit done. And there's even a famous Obama clip recently where he even said it himself. It's the number one trait he looked for when he was in the White House. And you'd see the interns and the junior staff. And it was like, how do you spot someone who you really want to have on the team? They said, they just get things done. They make things happen. It's like they just say, let me take care of that. And it just happens. They don't care how it happens. It's just effortless. They don't ask for thanks. They don't ask for a pay rise. They just get the work done and they go about it quietly and they're efficient about it. The second one is that they take on extra responsibility without being asked, right? Don't wait to be asked. If you want to be a high performer or be seen as a high performer in your organization, don't wait to be asked to be given extra responsibility. It's not a bad thing to be asked, but it means that you didn't show the initiative yourself, right? And by showing initiative and, you know, the previous point of getting things done, that's kind of a 1-2 knockout punch, really, for a lot of managers. It's like you get things done, they show initiative, they make it happen, and all of a sudden you're more than halfway to your next career discussion inside the company. So don't wait to be asked. Take on the responsibility, but not the really little stuff. Don't nickel and dime, let me do that bit of data entry or this. No, take something sizable on, right? Volunteer for something. Maybe it's just a bit too big for you to chew on. That's fine. Be part of the lean into it. Be part of the team. Learn, right? So I always look for people like that. And, you know, they don't come along often. When they do, they shine brightly, right? Just by the fact that they even volunteered to do it. And in order to do that, my third point is that, you know, you try to stretch beyond your ability, beyond the job you already have. Even if your job is quite challenging already, as human beings, we don't learn anything without stretching. It's like muscle memory. It's like you need to stretch to come back a bit, but you don't fall back where you started from. You're still ahead, right? So stretch these rock stars in companies, they stretch beyond their ability and maybe they don't get fully there, right? First time, second time, but there's always progress, right? And eventually they get there because they've got the endeavor. And the intuition to do it. A fourth trait, and this is actually a really great trait for consultants as well, is they learn quickly, right? It's like whether they've done this job for a long time or not, if it's a new task or a new role or you're teaching them to a new research methodology, whatever, all of a sudden they can just pick it up, right? And then they can use one of the other traits and just run with it. And it's like, wow. Because, I've trained taught people before, where I had to go over and over and over and over again. And, you know, some may be in the past, I was one of those people too. It's like, I don't get it.
I've been one of those people too. Yeah,
I'm not quite getting it yet. You know, just tell me again. Just show
how
me again.
How do I do this? What is
it? Yeah, it's just like, I'm going to the internet. I'm not asking anymore. It's just embarrassing. You know, but there's some people who just go, show me once, and like, they're off. And it's like, I've got incredible respect for that ability. I sometimes have it and sometimes don't. It depends. The second one's more of the last but one is sort of an external one. It's like, it's not what you do, it's what other people do, and that is they seek you out. They actually, the people in the organization, whether they know it or not, whether they go, oh, that person's a rock star, I'm going to go and ask them to do that, they may not make that direct correlation or that connection in their head, but they know this person and this person and this person get things done in a way, in a manner that, you know, is brilliant. And people seek them out. And we've got quite a few of those. We were very blessed at the Alliance, the Product Marketing Alliance. We've got a lot of young people. It's a very young group of people. I think the average age is about 24, which makes me a complete fossil. I'm sure if they're watching this, they call me grandpa. But whatever it is, you know, we've got a number of people in the comms team, marketing team, the events team, and they're in their early to mid-20s. And I am just so impressed with a lot of them. And I seek them out. I was like, if I call this person or this, but I just know they're going to respond within the hour. They're going to can do, it's going to get logged in Asana, and it's going to happen. Right. And that brings me to my last point, which is, as a consequence of all of these points combined, they're dependable, they're reliable, and they're predictable in a good way. You know, it's going to get done. You know, you can lean on them. You know, sometimes you can lean on them maybe a little bit more than you should. It's just like, I'm a bit late, or I don't have enough budget, or we need a little bit extra, and they just get it done, right? And you know that they can. So, you know, when you mix all these attributes together, it's quite a heady mix for high performers, or if you want to call them rock stars, we can, for high performers. And, you know, they're the ones that get fast-tracked in companies. They're the ones who get promoted quicker, and it's fully deserved. But, you know, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, how do I get promoted? I've got passed over twice, or however long it is. Just think about some of these attributes and, you know, be honest with yourself and go, which one of these am I? Which one of these do I have? Which one could I do better at? And what does that mean? What does that mean to me? What should I do about it? And everything's possible. Yeah.
Harvey, this has been one of my favorite conversations I've had on the podcast. I'm so glad that we were able to jump on and chat. This is now me talking to whoever's listening. hopefully you've been able to stick with us as we've kind of meandered into some obscure music facts. Hopefully this, if we have any other big music fans that are listening, definitely ping either me or Harvey and let us know what you thought about it. Or if you aren't really into like the classic rock or just rock or music kind of industry, if you still found it interesting, would love to know what you thought. Harvey, where can people follow you, and where can they learn more about your book?
So I pretty much hang out on LinkedIn. So you'll find me, if you just search Harvey Lee on LinkedIn, I'm the least hardest person to find on the internet, I think, outside of Bill Gates. So you'll find me on LinkedIn. I'm very, very engaged on LinkedIn. If you message me, I'll reply. If you leave a comment or repost one of my posts, I'm posting almost daily at the moment, I will respond. So I'm very engaged on LinkedIn. You'll also find me in the Slack channels for the Product Marketing Alliance. So if you're a product marketer, you'll find me on the Slack channels. If you want to come have a chat, or if you took one of our courses, you may come across me as one of the tutors or one of the mentors. So I look forward to our paths crossing if that's you. As far as the book's concerned, the book's called Backstage Pass. It's a, as you could probably gather if you've been listening to this podcast, it's a business book that is far from conventional. And it is 50% rock and roll, 50% business, but it's 100% true. And if you wanna understand how I helped launch the first Xbox, or why I even used a technology shift to launch a band, or why, as I illustrate on more than one occasions, why companies can be their own worst enemy, and what it's like to be in the crossfire of corporate takeovers more than once, and much, much more. It's really a career journal for people to sort of jump into. It's a story of nearly 40 years old, 40 years long, from school to quite recent times across multiple categories. And it's for people who are interested in their career, whether you're just getting started and looking for inspiration or wondering what it is, coming out of higher ed going, what does the world of work look like? Well, you could do worse by picking up the book. If you've been working for a while and you're a bit stuck for inspiration, you're like, I haven't got Metallica at work. I've just got this boring data stuff, or I'm frustrated with getting passed over or whatever, and you're seeking some inspiration, you know, you could do worse. And if you're like me and you've been around far too long and you like a good old retrospective and have a look at how things used to be, then it'll suit you as well. And if you happen to also be a music fan as well, it'll just add it even more to you. So if you're a music fan,
that's what I'm saying. If you look like me, then this is going to be fantastic. Yeah, 100%. And like, I'll link this, I'll link the book into the show notes.
Thank you.
And just so everyone can make sure that they pre-order it. But like I said,
it's going to come out early next year in Q1, and the pre-order will go live sometime in September. But you can find more information about the book.
Okay.
If you go to my website, so this is the bit I meant, at harvey-lee/book, and everything is linked off there.
Perfect. All right, Harvey, like I said, appreciate you hanging out. This is like I said, one of my favorites. Hope you have a great rest of your week and weekend.
It's been my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks, Andy.
Hey, you made it to the end of the episode. I have one small favor for you now. If you could please rate this podcast 5 stars wherever you're listening to it, that'd be super helpful for me. For Spotify, you can only leave a review on the mobile app, and you can do that on the top of the Healthy Competition podcast profile. And for Apple Podcasts, you have to scroll to the bottom of the show's page and click write a review. Each podcast episode takes about 5 hours of my time from beginning to end. While reviewing it, should only take about 5 seconds of your time. Plus, you'd be making my day. So thank you so much in advance, and see you in the next episode.